Hello, I'm Marcus Smith. Our next guest here on Constant Wonder has written these words. I have found, he says, that most people fall into one of three groups. They like plants, they like animals, or they like neither. Now, don't underestimate those words at all, because our guest is a scientist with keen powers of observation. His reputation is actually for bringing things together rather than just pulling them apart. And so these disparate three groups of people might come together, he contends, if only they understood the interconnectedness of things. Doug Tallamy is renowned for his work explaining the life sciences. Smithsonian Magazine has applauded him for his efforts to bridge the human-dominated landscape and the natural world. By profession, you could say he's a bug scientist, an entomologist, and he is a wildlife ecologist. Today we have the pleasure of visiting with him, occasioned by the appearance earlier this year of his volume titled The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. He's with us now on the line. Doug Tallamy, welcome to our show.
Well, thanks very much, Mark. It's very, very wonderful to be here.
You know, on the face of things, it seems that our job is to talk about oak trees, and that's going to be part of it for sure. But I kind of think that you would think that's a kind of a boring story if we tried to talk exclusively about the tree and shun any talk of anything surrounding it. In fact, I suspect you think that's kind of impossible to do.
Well, it's true. Oaks play a central role in the ecosystems around us, particularly in North America. They're great plants, so they're not boring. But don't worry, we'll talk about other things as well.
Well, okay, I want to start actually with another thing. Tell us, if you would, the story of the worst forest pest in North American history, as you've put it.
Gee, I get to choose.
I'm thinking gypsy moth.
Okay, gypsy moth. That would have been my first choice, but the emerald ash borer is certainly challenging that at this point. The gypsy moth was introduced in the late 1800s, kind of an interesting story. It was an entrepreneur who thought he could improve the silk industry by bringing over the gypsy moth that would make better silk. And he did that because the gypsy moth was misidentified as being a close relative of Bombyx mori, the silk moth caterpillar. He was going to breed them and have stronger silk. Well, it's not even closely related to the silk moth. So the idea was never going to work to begin with. But he had a colony in New England, Massachusetts, I believe. Storm knocked over his cage, and the gypsy moth got out. And we've been plagued ever since. Because they're attacking oak trees, primarily. When they run out of food, they'll eat just about anything. But as young larvae, they're oak specialists. And oaks are truly our most valuable ecological tree. So we can't afford to lose them.
So if I were to compare the danger of gypsy moths to oak trees with the danger to oak trees from humankind, who wins that war?
Oh, yeah, the danger from humankind exceeds that from gypsy moths. Gypsy moths can come through, defoliate, they cause a lot of trouble. Oaks die, but they're not destroyed. When you put in a shopping center, the oak is gone, and it's totally gone. There are something like 435 species of oaks in the world, and a third of them are endangered because of human activities. So that exceeds what the gypsy moth is doing.
And to complicate this whole picture, you say that oaks support more forms of life and more fascinating interactions than any other tree genus in North America. That's the tale I want to hear, because if it's such a central piece of living material, there are more facets here than I can even begin to number. But you certainly try to, don't you?
I try, but actually in the book I've only hit a fraction of what's going on with oaks. You know, when I say they're the most important trees, there are four things every landscape needs to be accomplishing ecologically. One of the most important things is to support the food web around that landscape. In other words, to support all the other life forms. It's plants that are capturing energy from the sun and turning it into food, and then they pass it on, and that's what allows the animal life to exist. And the more species you have in an ecosystem, the more stable it is, and the more ecosystem services it produces, which, of course, support us, but it supports everything as well. So we want plants that are going to pass on as much energy as possible, and oaks do that better than any other plant genus. And in terms of passing on energy, there is no creature better at doing that than caterpillars. I should say creatures. We have up to 14,000 species of caterpillars in North America. Well, oaks support, the latest count is 952 species of caterpillars, which is far, far more than any other plant genus. So in terms of supporting that food web in your yard, there's nothing that comes close to oaks. But oaks also are great at sequestering carbon, and we need to do that on every landscape. We need to manage the watershed, and oaks have wonderful root systems that do that better than most other plants. The only thing they're not superior at is supporting complex pollinator communities, and that's because oaks are wind-pollinated. Although there's recent evidence that a number of our pollinators do use oak pollen, they just don't move it to the female flowers, and they don't actually pollinate. But 3 out of 4 of the landscape goals are accomplished by oaks better than any other plant genus, so that's pretty good.
Well, I want to go back to that comment you made about how many caterpillars will feed upon oak trees. You also say that most insects have become very good at eating a few plants but are completely unable to eat most plants. This tells me that insects are specialists.
That's right. The insects that eat plants, at least 90% of them are highly specialized. And I could make an argument that they all are highly specialized if you look at the plants they cannot eat. So even our most generalized insects can only eat maybe 7% of the plants that are available to them, which means 93% are unavailable to them because they're so specialized on what they're able to digest.
So
the true specialists are eating, way less than 1% of the plants that are available to them. And the monarch butterfly illustrates that beautifully. You can have any kind of plant you want in your yard, but unless it's a milkweed, you will not support monarchs. And 90% of the insects that are out there are just like the monarch.
So it stands to reason from all that you've just said that with fewer oaks and all of these caterpillars specializing to a great degree in oak trees, you limit the oaks, you limit the population of those caterpillars, and the chain goes on down in the cascade, and then you have fewer caterpillars, I guess, for what? For birds?
Well, birds are what I typically talk about because people care about birds. But there are so many things that depend on insects and caterpillars in particular. And, it's the numbers that really are astounding. It takes thousands of caterpillars to make one clutch of birds. I always use chickadees as an example because we've got good data on chickadees. There's actually data on a number of bird species. 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to get one clutch of chickadees to the point where they leave the nest. And then the parents continue to feed them caterpillars another 21 days after they leave the nest. But they're flying all around, so nobody's counted those. That's tens of thousands of caterpillars to make one clutch of a bird that's a third of an ounce. That's 4 pennies worth of bird. And that's one pair of birds. You want a community of that species. You want a number of different bird species in your yard. So the number of caterpillars necessary to sustain bird populations in your neighborhood is astounding. And when we landscape with plants like eucalyptus or like crepe myrtle or all these other plants from Asia that are producing essentially no caterpillars, and we don't have to wonder why we've just lost 3 billion breeding birds in North America.
So are birds also specializing for their part? I'm wondering if they're going to be picky about their caterpillars.
Not really. There are caterpillars they avoid. They don't like hairy caterpillars, unless you're a yellow-billed or black-billed cuckoo that specialize on hairy caterpillars. But most birds don't like hairy caterpillars. Birds don't like distasteful caterpillars. So, we want to save the monarch, but not because it's a valuable part of the food web. They don't taste very good. But birds love those little green inchworms and unprotected, non-hairy caterpillars, and they will eat thousands of them every day.
So now we are already several degrees of separation away from sunlight. And I just want to review this, because if we talk sunlight going down to the oak leaf, the photosynthesis, the leaf can grow, the caterpillars can eat the leaves, the birds can eat the caterpillars. This is a fascinating tale, and I have read where you have talked about the idea that it's great for humans to be feeding birds, but the birds really have got to have the insects too.
So you're talking about actually putting out seeds for the birds. Yeah, no, that's right. Many people think that if you fill your bird feeder, you have done your job. And, of course, that helps. It helps for birds primarily in the wintertime that don't migrate because nearly all of them eat seeds. Not all of them, but most of them eat seeds during the winter. But typically, it's not their entire diet. So, for example, that chickadee that doesn't migrate, 50% of its diet remains insects, even in the wintertime. The golden-crowned kinglet, which ought to migrate but doesn't, it still eats caterpillars all winter long, even as far north as Maine. It's still finding those caterpillars that are spending the winter just sitting on branches. So seeds are great and help an awful lot of birds. But when it comes time to reproducing, most baby birds cannot eat seeds. So that's even the seed eaters have to switch to insects. When I say most, I mean most. 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. And again, most of those are caterpillars.
Yeah, what is that phrase from E.O. Wilson about the kind of the engines of all life? You know, it's like the small things that make the world go round. I don't know. I don't have it verbatim.
Insects are the little things that run the world. That is a quote from EO.
So then as you're talking about birds in the winter eating insects, I want to come back to the oak tree itself. The insects in the winter are available to the birds?
Yes, they are. If you were to climb an oak tree in the wintertime and come back down, you'd probably find caterpillars on your shirt. And I've done this, and I've always been surprised. What are they doing there in the middle of the winter? There's no green leaves for them to eat. They're simply sitting there. That's how they spend the winter. They look like sticks themselves. When it gets cold, they shrink a little bit. And when it gets warmer, they swell a little bit. But they're simply spending the winter. They're protected by proteins that protect their cells from freezing. So it's like antifreeze, and the cells don't burst. And that is what these birds are foraging. And you watch your oak tree or even other trees in the wintertime, you'll see little birds running around the branches, and it looks like they're eating things, and they are. Bernd Heinrich is the one that figured this out. He actually opened the crops of a number of birds, particularly golden-crowned kinglets, in January in Maine, and they were filled with caterpillars.
Wow.
So it's a big surprise to a lot of entomologists, but they spend the winter there, and the only thing we can think of is that they are there ready to go when those leaves come out. So if they spent the winter as an egg, they would have to hatch, and then they'd be very tiny. These things are nearly fully developed caterpillars, and they just have to eat a little bit before they complete their development in the spring. And that's what the birds are depending on.
You know, the oak story as providing food for birds, I would have gone first to the whole story of acorns. It shows you how little I know about birds and insects. But there are birds that also are very happy to get their beaks on those acorns.
There are many birds that depend on acorns. And sure, that's the obvious choice. Acorns are, you know, it's a wonderful source of food for birds and a number of mammals. But turkeys eat acorns and the number of woodpeckers, the acorn woodpecker specializes on acorns, but titmice and nuthatches and red-bellied woodpeckers and flickers. But jays have a really interesting relationship with acorns. And this, I'm talking about jays all over the world. That lineage evolved about the same time that oaks evolved in Southeast Asia. It was about 60 million years ago. So they've been together a long time, and it's a wonderful mutualism. Because jays depend on acorns for winter food, but they'll take acorns and fly up to a mile from the parent tree, and then they tap it below the surface of the soil. And the idea is they're going to go find it later on in the wintertime. But their memory is far from perfect. It's kind of like mine. They only remember where they put one and out of four acorns. And they can bury, you know, over 4,000 acorns per jay each winter. So they end up planting at least 3,000 new oak trees every year as far as a mile away from the parent tree. And that has allowed the genus Quercus oaks to move faster than any other tree genus in the world, that relationship with jays.
So it's not just that the birds are dependent upon the food provided by the tree, but the trees are dependent upon the birds for their expansion.
Exactly. And that has paid off a number of times, particularly when the glaciers came down and pushed oaks all the way down into the Gulf Coast, states or even down into Central America. When the glaciers receded, oaks were the first trees to return because those jays were moving the acorns far faster than any other type of seed.
Some of the greatest concerns I've had in recent years as I've thought about the world and our situation is that so many of these processes are so much slower than the change we are inflicting on the world. And so we can make an abrupt and cataclysmic change, whereas an oak tree, man, that can take a long time to grow. They're slow in their growth, aren't they?
They don't grow as slowly as people think, but they live a long time. So the generation of an oak tree is quite long. The average lifespan of an oak is 900 years. There's 300 years of growth, 300 years of stasis, and 300 years of decline. And during each one of those periods, they're delivering unique ecological contributions to the landscape around them. So you're right. We humans are changing things faster than plant and animal populations have the chance to adapt to those changes. That is a very serious problem.
Well, I'm thinking about the old adage that's attributed to China, the idea the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. And then I'm going to bring that together in conjunction with 17 years before an oak tree can start producing acorns?
Yeah. But, you know, my wife and I moved into a property, a farm that was broken up, had been mowed for hay. So there were nearly, it was barren. There were very, very few plants there. And one of the first things we did was to plant a number of acorns. So we planted our oaks as acorns. It's now 20 years later, and they are real trees. You know, they're pushing 50 feet tall, circumference of 47 inches. They're not mature. They're making their acorns now. They're still babies as oaks, but they're full-size trees in terms of the way we appreciate landscapes. So the idea that oaks grow slowly comes from the fact that the first couple of years, it looks like they're doing very little. They put up their first pair of leaves, and then they sit there. What they're doing is building their massive root system that will sustain their growth the rest of their life. People make a mistake. They want to plant an oak, but they want to get as big an oak as possible. So they'll spend $3,000 get a 50-foot oak. But to transplant that oak, it has to be totally root-pruned, which means it'll sit there for 10 years trying to rebuild that root system. Whereas if I had planted an acorn right next to that tree the same day, by the end of that 10 years, that acorn would be the tree would be taller and far healthier because it would start with a very healthy root system. When you transplant a large tree like that, you have 50% chance of dying. So go with the cheap, the free option, and you'll have a much healthier tree.
Now, you have talked about the idea that oaks are very important in the food web, providing things like acorns and their leaves. But in just a moment, I want to chat with you about how much more an oak tree does for the surrounding environs, the idea that what goes on in the roots is changing things, how the leaves amend the soil, if amend is a word we want to use. We're going to talk about all of that after a short break here on our show. Doug Tallamy is with us. He's author of The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. It's an honor to have with us Doug Tallamy. He is author of The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Doug, I just have to confess, I love the stories of these kinds of interactions. You know, when I was a kid and you'd pick up a textbook, you'd go to an encyclopedia maybe and you look up tree and it was all kind of narrow in its scope. And here you are an entomologist and you're talking about birds and you're talking, about the soil and fungus and groves, not just individual trees, but groves. Can we talk just a little bit about a grove of trees and why that's so important to consider?
A grove of trees is important because every time you turn on the news after there's been a thunderstorm or a hurricane, somebody shows you a picture of a tree that's fallen over on a house and crushed a car or crushed the house. So people say, well, I'm not going to plant any big trees, and I'm especially going to stay away from that big oak. And that's a terrible mistake. The problem is we're planting every tree, whether it's an oak or not, as if it's a specimen tree. We want it to reach its full grandeur, not compete with anything else. But that's not the way trees grow in a forest. They grow much closer together, and their roots intertwine with each other. It forms a root matrix underground, which makes them very stable. You can go to a stream cut where the water has washed away the soil from the roots next to the stream, and you can see how interconnected they are. And when they get to grow that way, the storm does not blow them over. A tornado might snap it off, and there's nothing you can do to prevent damage from a tornado. But if you plant a grove, and a grove could be as small as two trees, but I think three would be better, much closer together than you normally would think, maybe on 10-foot centers, their roots will intertwine with each other, stabilize each other, and they become nearly impossible to blow over when you have wind and rain together. So as a landscape attribute, we should give up the notion that everything should be a specimen tree and start embracing the aesthetic of a grove of trees. And if you look at them as a unit, they're still beautiful, and it creates much better habitat than a single tree, and they're much more stable.
So if a grove of trees can make for a better environment, a more stable situation there, let's also talk about this really interesting phenomenon where a tree like an oak will hang onto its leaves long after they've turned brown. How does that figure into this story?
Yeah, that's a condition called marcescence. It's exhibited a lot by oaks, particularly in the white oak group. That's a particular taxonomic group. And it's very prominent in lower limbs or young trees. Matter of fact, you can find leaves hanging on oaks in the white oak group up to about 18 feet tall. And after that, they start to fall off like normal leaves do. And they'll hang on there all winter long. So people wonder, what is marcescence all about? And the leading hypothesis is that it was an adaptation to protect the buds of that tree against browsing from the large mammals that used to inhabit the world. We'll just talk about North America, but there's a wonderful picture on the web of the large Pleistocene mammals that used to be in Mexico alone. And we're talking about three species of mammoths, the giant sloth, and a slew of other really large creatures that were browsers, just like the white-tailed deer. And that means they're snipping off the buds of trees, particularly during the wintertime. So the idea is that if the oak surrounds its new buds with the leaves from the previous year, which are not palatable, they don't taste good, very little nutrition in them, then it's not an attractive place for these mammals to feed. And you might think, well, it's a long time since those mammals have been here, but it's not a long time. It's less than 10,000 years ago that we had these big mammals. And they were around an awful long time, and certainly the oaks have not had a chance to change that valuable adaptation. What's really interesting is that marcescence, again, goes up the tree about 18 feet, and that was the maximum reach of that giant sloth. Couldn't get any higher than that, so why bother to hang on to your leaves above that? It's good support for that hypothesis.
So once those leaves actually do come down, though, let's start telling the story about how important oaks are to the soil. There's so many facets to this.
Yeah, I call oak leaf litter the most valuable type of leaf litter because it lasts longer than the leaf litter produced by maples or birches or tulip trees, which barely make it through a single season. But a single oak leaf can take 3 years to break down. And that's valuable because it forms a blanket on the soil, and that's exactly what the soil biota, all the creatures that live in the soil, require. All the soil creatures demand moisture, so they like high humidity. They've got to retain moisture in the soil. When you cover the soil with a blanket of oak leaves, you're protecting them from erosion, from heat, from the sun, from drying out, which is critical. There are more animals in the soil than there are above the soil, believe it or not. Now, they're all tiny, but they're there literally by the millions. And if the soil dries out, they cease to exist. And all those animals it's the animals and the predators that are eating them, are detritivores. They're the things that are turning over those old leaves. They're breaking them down, returning the nutrients to the soil so that the roots can take them up again the next year. And that's true for any type of leaf litter. We're starting to think of leaf litter in the way we've been thinking about rainwater. for the last several years. You want all the rain that falls on your property to stay on your property. You don't want it to run off. And you want it to infiltrate and recharge the water table underneath your land. Same thing with leaf litter. You want all the leaves that fall on your property to stay on your property so they can break down, protect the soil on your property, and return the nutrients that were used by the trees in your property that year. So when you rake up your leaves and burn them or put them out to the curb as if they were trash, you're depriving your trees of the nutrients that they need.
So you're going to have to unriddle me something here, which is there's this conventional wisdom among gardeners that the leaf litter can be a problem because it houses, you know, spaces for pests to persist over the winter. And so, I can't tell you how many times I've read, you know, get rid of the leaf litter. What's your answer to, aside from what you've just told me, that it helps to regenerate and provide habitat for, how do you mitigate the idea that you might have some kind of an apple worm lurking there and hanging around?
Oh, there's an awful lot to unpack with that question. Most of the horticulture industry is based on the premise that our plants are decorations, and you don't want anything to eat your decoration. You want it to be perfect. But, of course, you reflect back to our earlier conversation. If nothing eats that leaf, all the energy captured from the sun stays in the plant, and you have you've just killed your food web because you're not passing any of it on. So if you walk up to a plant in your property and you see no part of that leaf or the plant eaten, that plant is not doing its job. So it's true. A lot of things spend the winter in the leaf litter. Remember all those caterpillars that are running the food web? Well, 94% of them drop from the tree and either burrow underground to pupate underground, or they spin a cocoon in the leaf litter that is under the tree. And when we take the leaf litter around, both those things become very difficult. So in order to have all of those moths, they're mostly moths, not butterflies, complete their development, you want to retain your leaf litter. Now remember, when you have all of these things that are going to eat your plants and your property, you also have the natural enemies that keep them in check. We talked about birds, but birds are natural enemies. When they're eating thousands of caterpillars a day, it's hard to find any caterpillars on your property. You know, I give talks and show pretty pictures of caterpillars, and people say, "Oh, I can't find them." Well, that's right. The birds have eaten them first, but you won't have the bird if you don't have those caterpillars. So don't worry so much about your plants being defoliated or clobbered by these animals. It's all part of the natural cycle. That includes herbivores, well, includes the plants, the herbivores, and the predators and parasitoids and diseases that keep all of those things in check. You want to build a landscape that is a complete ecosystem where all the trophic levels are there interacting with each other, and they'll do it on their own. They don't need input from you. That's the ideal landscape.
Well, would you talk a little bit about carbon sequestration? Because I understand the oak is particularly robust in its capacity to make this happen. I actually think the word robust is connected with the word oak, if you go back in the etymology far enough.
Ah, interesting. Hadn't thought about that. But yes, oaks are wonderful carbon sequesters. Of course, we want to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and that's what plants do. And they take the carbon from the carbon dioxide molecule, and they build their tissues with it. But an important feature that most people don't recognize is that after they've built their tissues, they continue to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and then they start pumping it into the soil. So the soils around us are brown or black because of carbon that plant roots have deposited there over the eons. And soil scientists are now telling us that the soils around the world can store up to 7 times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere right now if we put the carbon back in the soil. But every time you plow soil, every time you turn it over to construction of any kind, you're releasing up to 70% of the carbon that was stored there. So we've done that for centuries now, and the goal is to get as much carbon back in the soil as possible. So anything with large root systems is going to be good at that. But oaks, of course, you want dense tissues and you want a long-lived tree if you're looking to store carbon out of the atmosphere. And oaks do both of those wonderfully. Now, we've talked about oaks being large. throughout this conversation, and most of them are. But I also want to emphasize there are a number of small species and dwarf species that are ideal for landscaping. So you can get those landscape attributes even if you have a small property. Because the first thing that goes through a lot of people's mind is, my property's not big enough for an oak, and I won't even think about it. But there's dwarf chestnut oak, dwarf chinquapin oak, there's a dwarf live oak down south. That are ideal for small properties. So they're actually ground cover oaks in the West. So oaks are not all of them are giants, and they can be used on smaller properties. There are 91 species of oaks in North America. So there are a lot of choices. But we have a few species of non-native oaks, like the English oak, that's Quercus robur, and Quercus sagittarius, the Chinese oak, which have been planted extensively because they make a lot of acorns, and they make those acorns quickly. The problem is that it's a Chinese oak. Far fewer creatures use Chinese oak compared to our North American oaks in North America. And the acorns they make are often too bitter for a lot of our wildlife to use. So, and now it has become invasive. It's, you know, it's moving on its own. You plant one, you get a whole bunch, and they're replacing our native oaks. Let's just, out of 91 species, we really don't need to go to China to find one.
Well, finally, I just love the underground stories that just seem to be so essential for us to understand. The things that are hidden from us sometimes can be the most important things to learn. And just the sheer scope, tell us the story. I don't know if it's legend or apocryphal, but the idea that in Scandinavia, people wanted to size up the extent of the root system.
Right. They were looking at the English oak. And so they decided they're going to dig it up. And they went in one direction. They followed the root system out, and they dug for 300 feet from the center part of the tree, and then they gave up. They never did hit the end of that root system. So the old adage that the roots of a tree go out to the drip line, they surely do, but they go far, much farther than that. And that's one of the reasons that our oaks aren't living 900 years these days, because where can you go 300 feet from the center of the tree before you hit a street or a sewer line or a foundation or something that blocks the growth of those roots? And that's what shortens the lifespan of our oaks. Many of us say, well, there's a 100-year oak. That's an old one. That's still a baby, and it's got a lot of growth that could happen if we treated those roots a little bit better.
One of the things I've enjoyed as I've gotten to know your work is the idea that you can disabuse us of a few myths. And that one more myth here to consider is the idea that mistletoe is trying to kill your tree.
Right. Mistletoe is there so you can get a kiss. We all know that. mistletoe is a parasitic plant, but that's kind of a nasty word to describe it, because it does photosynthesize itself and gets most of its nutrients from surrounding rain. Its root system does tap into oak branches a little bit, but you have to have a really terrible mistletoe infestation along with really terrible weather in order for the oak to actually suffer. Mistletoe itself is a valuable plant. They produce valuable berries. The western bluebird, for example, really depends on mistletoe berries on oak trees. There are specialist butterflies that some of the lycaenids that only eat mistletoe from oaks. A number of moths, like the beloved Emarginia, I love that name, looks just like a piece of lichen, develops on the mistletoe on oaks. So it's part of the diversity that is out there. And again, this notion that you have to have a perfect plant, nothing can be on it, that's perpetuated by the horticultural trade, you know, the things we should ignore. I don't have any mistletoe on my oaks because I'm just a little bit too far north. But in southern Delaware, they start to appear, and I wish I had them. I'd have a lot more diversity on my property if I did.
Doug, I can't let you go without asking you, and I know you've given this message so many times, but I guess the best way to put this is that it's been implicit in much of what you've said that we should be supportive of fostering of oak trees, planting more of them, getting them here, there, and the other place, wherever we can. But I know part of your aim is to – well, this is parallel to the idea that you can have citizen scientists, you can have citizen journalists, you can have citizen participation. You're really big on the idea that people can get involved in their very own yards. And just a little bit more about that concept of why it really matters.
I'm big on the idea that people have to get involved in their yard. Everybody on the planet requires a healthy ecosystem, not just environmentalists, everybody. So why wouldn't everybody have the responsibility of being good earth stewards? We all should be stewarding the environment, whether you own property or not. If you don't own property, help somebody who does. But we need to start creating ecologically robust landscapes wherever we go. They can be beautiful, too. That could be a challenge for the horticulture trade, but they have to be ecologically functional because we're everywhere. We have parks and we have preserves, but they are too small, too few, and too isolated to sustain the amount of nature that we need to sustain us on this planet. And that's why we're seeing these terrible statistics about global insect decline and the loss of 3 billion birds. And the UN says we're going to lose a million species in the next 20 years. That's not an option. That is simply not an option. We've got to turn – we have an adversarial relationship with nature that's got to become a collaborative one. And everybody on the planet has to understand that and contribute to it.
Doug Tallamy, a pleasure to get to know you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Doug Tallamy with us. He is author of The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees, and of course, so well known for his book, Nature's Best Hope. Oak trees live in rich communities and foster dense ecosystems, fair enough, but there is one tree that takes community and interdependence to the extreme. And by one tree, what I'm talking about here is literally one tree, if you can call it that. Just happens to be widely regarded as the largest living organism on Earth. It's an aspen clonal colony named Pando. At least that's what we humans call him. It is a him, male. And we're going to meet him next on Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. You could say that trees are complex or social, more social than we ever supposed, willing to share their strengths, their nutrients with other species, animal or vegetable. They get something in return, of course. Trees share like that. But sometimes what looks like a community of trees is in fact a single individual. By now, you may have heard of Pando, thought to be the heaviest single organism on the planet, also one of the oldest. To learn more about Pando, we spoke with an expert who has spent a lot of time with Pando, worrying about him. Yes, Pando is a he. Paul Rogers is director of the Western Aspen Alliance and an adjunct associate professor of environment and society at Utah State University.
Probably the largest living things on Earth that we know of, and that's for those people want to get technical, by dry weight mass. There are some very large fungi that spread across big areas, and they are also mostly underground. But this is the heaviest thing that we know on Earth. The one thing I would like to correct, or sort of correct, is the age of this. We really have very little idea. I like to tell people this grove is certainly centuries old, likely millennia old, but we do not have a way to date it. So there's been some estimates out there in the media of 10,000 or 80,000 or even a million years of age, but we do not have a solid way of confirming that. So I kind of stay away from the oldest living thing, but I feel a lot more confident about the largest living thing we know of at this time on Earth.
Yeah. Would you say that – do the bristlecone pine comparison for me there.
Okay. So bristlecone pine, is the ones that have been aged are somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000, 4,500. I don't have that exact number on me. Years of age. And that's a single stem of a tree that's grown and stayed on this planet for that long living. That's pretty darn cool. But this organism, this giant Pando grove of aspen, you know, right here in the state of Utah, is certainly been around a long time. It's just we can't put an exact date on it like we do with tree rings. And the more interesting thing, and I'm going to go down the geeky science lane a little here.
Oh, please do.
It's the genetics of this that have been around a long time. Whether any single cells in that giant grove have lived that long. We don't know that either. We do know, we have a much better feel for the present day and how large it is, and we've done some colleagues of mine here and elsewhere have done some testing on the genetics. So we're pretty confident about that. And by the way, you said 160 acres. It's 106 acres, or for those metrically influenced, it's 43 hectares.
You know, you are so helpful because you're not only correcting me, but you know a whole lot more that we're going to get to right now, because I want to know if this compares. When you say it's genetically the same organism, would mm-hmm. this be like a clone that has more of itself that it makes, and then maybe part of it dies, but then it keeps making more of itself? So there's a continuity there.
Exactly. I like the way you put that. So it's kind of fun to think about for me, and it's kind of a mind bender too. But you think about when I walk into a forest, it looks like a forest of a lot of individual trees. Well, this particular forest is a forest. I like somebody came up with the phrase, a forest of one tree. So what those estimated 47,000 stems on those 106 acres are actually one genetically identical being. So that's pretty cool. But what I really like about this is it kind of makes you question and look a little bit more deeply, more philosophically, what is an individual and what is a community? What is a tree and what is a forest?
Have you figured that out yet?
No, I haven't, but it's sure fun to think about. I like to put it in the context of people. I use this analogy a lot. Imagine a town, a small city that was 47,000 people. And somehow we were all connected. We had the same genes. Wow, that would be a pretty strange to think about. I wouldn't want to walk around a town where everybody else was like me, that's for sure, and had the same traits and all. But also we might live and die at the same rate. We might have some of the same biological functions, and that would be a risky ecological scenario. So bringing it back to Pando and bringing it back to what's a community and what's an individual, I like to think of this in a positive light, is that we're all connected in some way as humans, and in this forest we're all connected, or they're all connected, all those trees, and they're also connected in some ecological ways to all the other plants and animals living in that system. So that's a mouthful I just said.
Well, I like it a lot, and what I'm going to do now is say that a town of 47,000 people might be connected, but they're not connected at the toes physically.
That's correct.
And so I'm imagining this grove of aspen trees actually having their toes connected.
That's correct. And I like, again, a nice analogy there. So those root systems are connected for the most part, as far as we know. And here's the real rub, Marcus. That community, whether it's humans or trees, if all of those 47,000, or the vast majority, if they were, in human terms, if they were all 85 years of age, we'd be in a really risky scenario. And that kind of brings us to the problem here at the Pando Aspen Grove. Those tree stems are about 115, 120 years of age, and aspen don't live much longer than that. So we've got the demography of this community of 47,000 tree stems is highly weighted toward the old age realm. And so that's where the puzzle comes in. There's a lot of different generations that are missing, you might say, for it to be a sustainable forest.
So with the information you just gave me, given the fact that I didn't make it to go see Pando, but if I had gotten there, and if I knew that these old trees, I call them trees, and I guess I shouldn't even call them that, but I don't, you know, you can help me with that a little later. But if I were to see the thing, and if I were to look for some kind of a sign of illness, mm-hmm. what I would see is a whole bunch of really big trunks on these things and very few small trees?
That's exactly correct. Again, I'll use the human analogy. It's not perfect, but imagine walking into that town and everybody's a senior citizen and you're looking around and you're saying, where's the babies, where's the teenagers, where's the young adults, and so on. They're all missing the different in the tree scenario. They're all... Where's the different sizes, both width and height of these, the next generation ready to move in as the older ones die off? And it's pretty stark once you have an eye for that. You know, it's almost like a park in the city or a cemetery in which we groom the lawn, but it's not a natural forest, and we have all these mature trees in there, but we're missing all those different generations. And in most forest situations around the world, that's what makes them sustainable, and that's kind of how we function as a community too, is we need those different age cohorts and levels of health and so on in order to have a community over a longer period than one generation.
So we got to get to the crux of this eventually. I want to know, do you know where the babies are, the little small ones, or why they're not there?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. But let me back up. In this recent paper, we started putting a fix on it. We know that a time fix on this, and we know that those that grove has been around a long, long time. And suddenly I started with some aerial photographs from 1939 and then from up until the recent past, about six photographs, looking at the exact same area of the grove, and I noticed it was thinning out and thinning out, meaning there was more spaces between the trees. So I can see that on the ground right now there's very few young ones, but I wondered kind of when that started. It was a thick grove at one point, and it looked like in the 1960s or 70s, things started to change pretty rapidly. And when I had first visited there about 10, 15 years ago with some U.S. Forest Service personnel, they showed me an area that they had cut down in 1992 and put a fence around, and there was lots of young growth. So we started putting two and two together. By the way, they were a little embarrassed that a deer had gotten inside of their fence and was trapped inside there. But we started putting two and two together, and then we started taking actual data. And we came to find out that every time a new sprout comes up, it's being browsed. We don't use the phrase grazing because that refers to eating herbaceous plants, but eating woody plants is browsing. So every time a new sprout came up, a baby, if you will, it's the top was eaten off. Sometimes it's eaten all the way down to the ground and we don't see any plant parts. Well, if you multiply that by two or three or four decades, pretty soon those formerly middle-aged trees have grown to mature height, and we're missing that generation, and that's quite evident now. And we're missing it primarily in this case because there's both deer and cattle that are browsing on this area. We don't see much sign of elk, which is a much bigger issue. If we have time, we'll get to that around the western states. But Rocky Mountain mule deer and domestic cattle are browsing any new growth off, and if we multiply that by several years, we start missing generations. So that's in a package, that's kind of the phenomenon that's going on there. And now we have to untangle that a bit and see how we can get this set back on a more sustainable track.
You know, I'm thinking a little bit about this thing called succession ecology, where you look at how something starts out, maybe there's been some disturbance, a fire or something. Mm-hmm. And then as things grow back, it comes in a certain order, and it starts with grasses and small things, and eventually you work your way up towards a forest. You just said that like a generation has been missing. Is that a gap in this succession? I mean, is it conceivable that from the roots you could have these little small saplings come back up and they would be okay even though there's that missing generation?
Yes, that's a great question. And actually, there's several missing generations at this point, but because they do try to grow each year. But you've raised a good question there. So aspen succession usually is after a big disturbance. Let's say we had a big wildfire. Aspen grows very fast because it doesn't have to grow from seed primarily. It grows from roots. So basically all the reproductive parts are ready to go, and we shoot the starting gun, and off they go. And even within 2 months of a fire, we can see 1 to 2 to 3 foot high aspen stems, whereas any plant growing from seed would probably be the following year before we saw that coming up. So it has a wonderful head start, and this is where aspen grows intermingled with conifers, which is the dominant type across the western U.S. However, there's a second type of aspen, and this is what we call a pure or stable type, which is what the Pando Grove is, and much of the aspen across the Colorado Plateau region, where it grows in really with no other tree species, and it's actually not very flammable at all, so we can't count on that type of disturbance to be a rejuvenating mechanism. So here the succession is just aspen replacing itself. And that's what's going on or should be going on at Pando. But we've seen through the browsing of these, what we call ungulates, and that just means animals that have hooves, but browsing hooved animals, in this case deer and cattle, an interruption of that successional cycle. So I think that's what you were implying, and I think you're just dead on with that analogy.
Dr. Rogers, I do want to get to the question about what's been eating them. You mentioned ruminants. You mentioned cows, cattle that are browsing there, the mule deer in the area. We'll get to elk in just a second, but I want to go back to this notion that you mentioned earlier, that the aspen function in a system and are connected to the system around them. Could you just kind of describe how they're connected and what functions or interconnections or interactivity they have in their ecosystem?
Yes, it was a great question, and I wanted to circle back to that issue, so I'm glad you brought it up. So I like this one word, biodiversity. So among Western forests, aspen are among the most biodiverse, meaning they support a lot of plants and animals, basically, without going into too much details, because those forests hold a lot of moisture, and so we got a lot of different plants and animals. And a key point here is that as aspen forests go, all those species that are dependent on them also will diminish. So what I meant by that connectedness comment earlier is that as that forest opens up and more mature trees die and are not replaced by younger aspen, we can expect it to dry out and have fewer plant species, and then we'll have fewer animal species supporting it. So there are cascading effects, you might say, of losing that overstory, and we can multiply that by aspen all across the western U.S. and, in fact, around the whole northern hemisphere, which is something new that I'm getting into and connecting different countries and their aspen in something I'm calling mega conservation. So that was a mouthful.
You know, the area would dry out, you say.
Yes.
Is that just simply a factor of shade, or are there other things going on there?
There's shade going on there, but as deciduous trees lose their leaves, they form more organic soil that decomposes, and that holds more water, so that richer soil has more water and actually carbon-holding capacity. So there's a lot of connections there already, but as we lose that overstory of mature trees, we'll have other plants, invasive plants, sometimes sagebrush, and the soils can actually change over time too, so that they can no longer support such a rich diversity of plants and animals.
Paul Rogers, director of the Western Aspen Alliance and an adjunct associate professor of environment and society at Utah State University. Up next here on Constant Wonder, grab your popcorn and lean back in the easy chair. We're going to have a bit of a flashback to the 1980s and the most famous film critic duo ever to grace your television set. Siskel and Ebert, I'm talking about, at the movies, next on Constant Wonder.